Hi guys, this is Paul Gray from Leaders in Business and Investing. Today I'm joined with Dr. Jonah Berger. He's a marketing professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an internationally best-selling author of Contagious, The Invisible Influence, as well as his most recent book, The Catalyst. Dr. Berger is a world-renowned expert on change, word of mouth, influence, and how products, ideas, and behaviors catch on. He teaches Wharton's highest rated online course, which I highly recommend you guys all check out. And he's hosted hundreds of events at different organizations like Google, Nike, Apple, and the Gates Foundation. Dr. Berger, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So can you begin first by discussing what led you to write your new book, The Catalyst?
Yeah, so a few years ago, I wrote Contagious, and that changed my life a little bit. So in my day job, I'm a professor at the Wharton School. I teach marketing there. I do a lot of academic research, and most of my time was research and teaching. When Contagious came out, it was a lot bigger than I expected it would be. It ended up coming out in over 40 different languages, over 500,000 copies, I think, or maybe even more now around the world, and started being asked to talk to a variety of companies and organizations about different challenges, everything from getting products and services to catch on to changing the way the organization worked. And I learned a lot about the way that different companies operated. And what I realized is that everyone had a similar problem. They all had something that they wanted to change. So, folks in marketing and sales, they wanted to change consumer behavior or a client's mind. Employees wanted to change their boss's mind, and leaders wanted to transform organizations. Startups wanted to change industries, and nonprofits wanted to change the world. But what I started to realize is that change was really hard. Right? People would often push and pressure and cajole, and often nothing budged. And so the question I started to ask is, well, could there be a better way? Could there be a better way to change minds and drive action other than just pushing? And that's sort of what led to the most recent book.
Very nice. And you just touched on the fact that most people don't really want to necessarily change easily, if that's the correct way of saying it. But why is that? Is that just human psychology? Is that our innate nature?
Yeah. I mean, we all have something called the status quo bias. So whether we're talking about products we buy at the grocery store, funds we invest in, places we go on vacation, management practices at the office, we're all sort of attached to the status quo, what we're doing already. And think about it in a home buying context, for example. The longer someone's lived in a home, the more they value that home above market price because it's theirs. They've become attached to that thing that they're already doing. There's some nice research, for example, that shows that the valuation of something, people that already have that thing value it more than people that don't. So for example, if I showed you a Wharton coffee mug, I said, hey, how much would you pay for this Wharton coffee mug? You might say, I don't know, $5, $4, $5. But if I gave this coffee mug and it's yours, and I said, well, how much would you sell it for? Well, it should be the same thing, right? The valuation of that mug should be the same whether you have it or not. But if you're buying that mug, if you don't have it, you value it a lot less than if you already have it already. And so that's why firms stick with the old way of doing things. That's why consumers buy the same products again and again. And so it's very hard to overcome that. And so a lot of the book is really about, well, how do we overcome that status quo bias by understanding how it works?
Got it. And in your journey in writing the book, what were some tricks that you learned along the way that those that are watching would find useful in their everyday lives?
Yeah, I think what I realize is we tend to take a certain approach to change. So say there's a chair in the middle of a room, for example. If we want to move that chair, we tend to think pushing is a good idea. Push that chair in a particular direction and it will go. And indeed, pushing is really good for chairs, works very well when we apply it to chairs. When we apply that to people, though, it doesn't work so well, right? Whether that person is your boss, a colleague, or your employees, when we try to push people, they often push back. Right? They often don't do what we suggested. In fact, they often do sometimes the exact opposite. And so if pushing doesn't work, what does? Well, it turns out there's a great analogy to be made with chemistry. And so in chemistry, as some of your listeners might know, change takes a long time, often eons, if not millions of years, for carbon to change into diamonds or plant matter to change into oil. And so chemists often use temperature and pressure to make it happen faster, squeeze things together, heat them up, they change. But there's a special set of substances that allows the same amount of change to happen, not with more temperature or more pressure, but less. And those substances have won numerous Nobel Prizes. They clean everything from the grime on our contact lenses to the car engines that we drive around. And those things are called catalysts, right? They don't push harder. They don't add more energy. They reduce the amount of energy required. And it turns out the same thing is true in the social world. Rather than pushing, rather than saying, well, what could I do to get someone to change? A much more effective approach is often, well, why hasn't that person changed already? What's stopping them, right? What's getting in the way? And so the book is really all about identifying those barriers that prevent change. If we think about, we get into a car, for example, trying to start our car, we stick our key in the ignition, we put our foot on the gas. If it doesn't work, we think we just need more gas. But often, well, we got to depress that parking brake as well, right? We don't necessarily need more gas. We got to figure out what's in the way. And so the book talks about the five key barriers or parking brakes that often get in the way of change and how we can mitigate them.
Got it. Okay. Another thing that I saw you wrote in the book, which I found very interesting and useful in my everyday life, was the fact that sometimes when you're speaking to a client, it's not enough just to come up with one very good example. Because when you only offer one example, they tend to pluck as many holes in it as possible.
Yeah, so what you're talking about is actually the first barrier in the book, and that is reactance. And the simple idea of reactance is when we push people, they push back. When we tell people what to do, when we make a suggestion, they often don't want to go along with that suggestion, whether that person is a three-year-old that you have at home that won't go to bed, or whether that person is a client that you're trying to get to take an investment recommendation. And the reason why is that people like to feel like they're in control, like they have freedom and autonomy, like they're in the driver's seat. Why did I make this choice, invest in this fund, take this particular course of action? I did it because I want to, because it's my choice. But as soon as it comes from us, now it's hard to tell where that locus of control is, right? Did I do this because I wanted to do it? Or did I do it because that person suggested it? And the more I feel like it's because they suggested it, the less interested I am in doing it. And in some sense, people have an ingrained anti-persuasion radar. It's almost like a missile defense system or a spidey sense, a set of defenses that go up when people feel like someone's trying to change them. So, you know, we ignore the message, we have sales call, someone calls us up, we don't want to buy something, we hang up the phone, we avoid it. Or even worse, as you were talking about, we counter argue. Yes, it seems like we're listening, but really what we're doing there is we're sitting there thinking about all the reasons why what someone else suggested is wrong, why it won't work, why it's going to be too expensive, why it's not going to pay off. And so because of that, we need to take a different approach. We need to figure out how to, rather than persuade people, get them to persuade themselves, rather than trying to sell people, get them to buy in, right? Make them feel like it was their idea in the first place, or, and I'm happy to talk about some of the applications, how to do this, but really give them that sense of freedom and autonomy back.
And how important is it when you're speaking to a client or an investor, perhaps, to ask questions to get them to come to your conclusion as opposed to just pushing?
Yeah, so a couple things, right? So first, as you just talked about, asking rather than telling, right? If you say, hey, you should do this, someone's going to say, no, I don't want to, right? Think about how well masks are, when the government says wear a mask, people say, oh, I don't know if I want to wear a mask, right? I might have been happy to wear it if it came from me, but because it came from the government, I'm pushing back. And so asking rather than telling, what do you think about this industry? What do you think about this investment? Asking questions that guide the journey to the conclusion you want them to get to, because if they come up with it themselves, they're much more likely to make that choice. There was a boss, for example, that was talking to his employees and wanted to get them to stay late. And he realized, look, telling them to stay late is not going to work because they don't want to do it. So instead he said, well, what kind of company do you want to be? Do you want to be a good company or a great company? Mm-hmm. What do people say in that situation? They say, oh, we want to be a great company. Okay, how do we get there? So they list off different things. And then once he says, okay, well, I like your suggestions, let's pick these. It's very hard for those people then not to go along with their suggestions because they came up with it themselves. They committed to the conclusion. So the main idea of reducing reactance is, well, how do you give back that sense of control? Providing a menu, which is another approach I talk about in the book, does the same thing. Rather than giving people one option, as you talked about before, I give them two. Rather than a meeting sort of giving people one thing where they're poking holes in that one thing, if you give them two, well, now they're thinking instead, well, why don't I like this? They're thinking, well, which one of these do I like better? And because they're focused on which one they like better, they're much more likely to pick one at the end of that meeting, right? Great consultants and salespeople do this all the time. They present two or three, not 10 options, but two or three options, knowing that giving that listener the sense of choice will make them more likely to go along with one of the options and more likely to change as a result.
Very interesting. Okay. Another barrier that I saw a lot of direct correlation to myself and to people in my own life is uncertainty. Sometimes when a new product or service comes our way, we typically cast doubt on it right away because we're not really used to it. And it's typically because it's not the status quo and what we're used to.
Yeah, and so what you're talking about is sort of, you know, there are two sides to change. One is our attachment to the old, and that's endowment. And so the five key barriers, since I don't think I said them already, is reactance, endowment, distance, uncertainty, and corroborating evidence. Put those five together, they spell the word reduce, which is exactly what great catalysts do. They reduce the barriers to change. We talked a little bit about reactance, right? The fact that when people are pushed, they push back. Endowment is that attachment to what we're doing already. Uncertainty is the flip side of it. Right? Uncertainty is about the new thing. Endowment's about the old thing. We're attached to the old way of doing things. Uncertainty is our reticence to do something new. And part of the reason why is new things are often costly, right? There's almost always a switching cost, a cost of change. In the product context, right, we have to buy something new. It costs some money. But even in another context, it takes time and effort to do something new. Take a new investment, right? I know how my old investment does. I know it goes up, it goes down. I have some sense of how it works. If you're asking me to do something new, well, how do I know it's going to be better, right? Sure, I know what I'm doing already. It may not be perfect, but at least I know how it does. You're asking me to do something new. Well, how do I know that it will be better than what I'm doing already? And notice the challenge there, right? The cost is now, the benefit is later, right? Yep. Switching to a new investment, well, hey, you know, I have to decide whether I want to do that and potentially put some effort into it. At the end of the day, it may be better, it may be worse. The cost is now, the benefit is later. And so one challenge is how do we get people to overcome that cost-benefit timing gap, right? And one way to do it is to lower the barrier to trial. Make people feel more comfortable doing new things by allowing them to experience it themselves. So I'll use an example from Dropbox, which is an organization probably many of you are familiar with. They do cloud storage, right? And they're very successful today, a billion-dollar business, but they weren't always successful. When they launched, they had a lot of challenges getting traction. Why? Because their business was different than what people were used to. They were used to storing things on their desktop. And once you've spent a long time working on a file or photos, you don't want to worry about losing them. And so why do you want to put them in the cloud and they could just be on your desktop? And so they thought, well, we can invest money in marketing and advertising. What they ended up doing is giving it away for free. So what they did is say, hey, look, anyone who wants to try Dropbox, you can get 2 gigabytes of storage for free. You might be sitting there going, well, hold on. How do you build a business giving away for free? Don't you have to charge? But they didn't just give it away for free, right? Anyone who's had a lemonade stand knows you have to charge something for. What they did is they gave it away for free, but then they encouraged people to upgrade to a premium version. They use something called freemium, which many of you are probably familiar with. There's a free version of a product, but there's also an upgraded premium version. And what they did is said, look, try Dropbox. I'll lower the barrier to trial. I'll make it free to use. And if you like it, you put all your files on there, you'd be willing to upgrade to the more expensive, costly version because you know it works. And you can think about the same thing even beyond freemium. Yes, freemium is a business model. Yes, lots of organizations have used it. But think about test drives of cars. There's no freemium there. There's no free version and premium version. But what test drives do is they lower that uncertainty, right? Right. They allow people to go, wait, you know, I don't know whether I'd like this car brand or not. Let me go sit in the car. Let me try it out before I have to pay all that money, making me more comfortable in trying it. Samples at the grocery store, same thing. I don't know if I'd like this new type of food. Well, if I get a sample and it's pretty good, I'm more likely to buy it, right? And so anytime you want to get people to do something new, figure out, well, how can I lower the cost of trial and make it easier for people to experience the value so that rather than just having to listen to me, they can go, well, okay, I've experienced it myself. It's quite good. I'm going to be willing to do it.
So it builds that trust factor, which otherwise wouldn't be there necessarily.
Yeah, and notice there's a difference between you trust me versus you trust your own experience, right? So you're a trustworthy individual, we're all trustworthy individuals, but people trust themselves more than they trust people trying to change their mind, right? And so what uncertainty does is saying, hey, don't actually trust me. You don't have to trust me that Dropbox is good, because of course, if I'm Dropbox, I'm going to say Dropbox is good. Instead, what it says is, hey, look, try it yourself. We're so convinced you're going to like this, try it yourself. And if you like it, you'll be willing to pay a couple bucks to upgrade to the premium version.
Got it. Okay. That's very interesting because, you know, I come from the investment management side of things. And typically when you speak to an investor and they're opposed to your investing style, it's typically because either number one, they don't really trust you, or number two, they're not really used to that strategy. But I never heard of a manager say, you know what, I'll give you a test drive. We'll do this for 6 months or a year. So that would be totally revolutionary.
Yeah, or you might even say, look, you know, don't, depends on the type of investing we're talking about, but, you know, take my own experience, you know, don't just say, hey, I want your whole portfolio. Say, just give me a small chunk. A small little bit of it. Let's try it for 6 months. And if I don't hit the goals that you say, great, I'll give it back, right? Or, you know, you can go invest it with someone else. And so if you're certain that what you're doing is good, which you should be if you're offering it, then figure out a way to lower that barrier to trial. Give people a way to experience themselves. Like, you don't have to trust me. I hope you trust me, but you don't have to trust me. The proof is in the pudding, right? I'm so sure this is going to work. Do it for 6 months, take a small chunk. And if it works, then we'll agree to do a larger chunk.
Well, that's an interesting point, too, because in the book, you speak a little bit about negotiation, right? Where you talk about, you know, typically when people negotiate, they're like, it's all me. Let me bring them to my side of the deal. And then you suggest maybe you should start off by coming closer to their solution and then working your way back to your own.
Yeah, I call this asking for less. Right. Sometimes we ask for so much, we want such a big change that people are unwilling to do it. I was talking to a doctor, for example, who's trying to get an obese trucker to lose weight. He was drinking 3 liters of Mountain Dew a day, which is a huge amount of sugar, way overweight. The tendency there is to say, well, don't drink any Mountain Dew. Right? Well, sure, that's a great idea. But is a person who drinks 3 liters of Mountain Dew a day really going to quit cold turkey? Probably not. So instead, what she did is said, okay, you know, I see you like Mountain Dew. No problem. You can still drink Mountain Dew. But rather than drinking 3 liters a day, let's try just going down to 2. Take a third empty bottle, put some water in it, put in the cab of your car. And he grumbled. He didn't want to do it. Eventually was able to do it. Comes back. She says, great, you did such a good job. Now let's try going down to 1. Oh, I don't know. Okay, I was eventually able to do it. Eventually goes down to 0. Eventually loses 35 pounds. Why? Because she didn't just ask for less. She started by asking for less, and then she asked for more. Right? Essentially, what she did is she took big change and she broke it down into smaller chunks and moved people one chunk and then the next chunk and the next chunk and so on. And product designers use this idea a lot. They call it stepping stones, essentially. So, you know, think about a new version of a product or service. If it's very different from what people are used to, they'll say, oh, it's too far. Right? I'm not willing to try it. It's too new of a technology. And so what I often do is they'll create in some sense, a dumbed down version of the technology, a reduced feature version of the technology that's closer to what people are doing already, that they'll feel more comfortable. So they'll take a little hop and then they'll move it. Take a little hop and then they'll move it and take a little hop and move it. And so, you know, a big river may look really difficult to ford. It looks deep. It looks, you know, like currents rushing. I don't want to go across. But if there's some stones along the way that I can hop to, I'm much more willing to make that crossing. And so rather than just asking for all of it right away, chunking the change, making it easier, and people are more likely to make the switch.
Understood. Okay. So by lowering your own expectations, you make it seem like it's more achievable for them.
Yeah, it's not just your own expectations, right? It's literally lowering your ask, starting with a smaller ask, right? Just like, for example, we talked about a small portion of your portfolio. Sure, I want the whole thing eventually, and I think I should get it, but recognizing that you may not be willing to make that big change right away, and rather than dismissing the whole thing, I'd rather you take a small step, move in my direction, and then continue to move you there over time.
Correct. Okay. You know, there was a lot of amazing insight in this book. And for all those who would like to get in touch with you directly, how could they do so, Dr. Berger?
Oh, yeah, sure. First of all, thank you for having me, by the way. It's great to chat. Best place to reach me is my website. So just Jonah, J-O-N-A-H, Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R.com. You can find out about the books there, but there's also a whole bunch of free resources. So how to change your boss's mind, how to change a client's mind, a one-pager you can download and work through the ideas if you're interested. You know, I think change often seems really hard, but if we understand this toolkit, we can really change anything.
Very nice. It's a pleasure having you, and I hope to talk again soon.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.